We are wrapping up week two of the Karen Reed murder trial here in Dedham, Massachusetts. And honestly, it's only getting more and more interesting.
Now to the latest in the Karen Reed murder trial. Today, jurors heard from the homeowner and his children who were home the night of John O'Keefe's death.
Brian Albert Jr. is the first witness to place Karen Reed's car at the scene of the crime. Albert testified that he sat at the family dining room table that snowy night, and looking out of these two windows, he saw a dark SUV near the mailbox, its passenger side facing the house. Karen Reed and John O'Keefe captured on camera embracing on January 28, 2022 at a Canton bar. Witnesses say the group was invited to 34 Fairview Road in Canton. What happened next is for the jury to decide.
High status within the community. Chris specifically, he's a city selectman, he owns a local pizza shop, and his wife Julie is very close friends with the sister of the lead investigator on this case. So all of this for the defense really just painted a picture that Karen Reed is being framed to protect the Albert family and some of their friends.
Brian Albert grew up in and later owned the home on 34 Fairview Road. He sold the residence in 2023. Albert served as a Marine and then joined the Boston Police Department, where he worked for about 30 years. He was a sergeant detective and is now retired.
Karen Reed's attorney Alan Jackson grilled Brian Albert on the stand today during his testimony. We asked Jackson when he was leaving court if he thinks it's possible that the Alberts could have been sleeping through all the commotion of that morning. He said he did not, adding that he thought it was impossible their dog Chloe could have either.
Another week of trial is behind us in the case of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus Karen Reed. In the last episode, we heard from the brother of Officer John O'Keefe, as well as his wife, and from the first responders on scene. Since then, we've heard from the Canton police officers who were in charge of the initial investigation and evidence collection, as well as the witnesses from Waterfall and C.F. McCarthy's, including close friends of John, the bartender, and the homeowners at 34 Fairview, among others. We are now a couple weeks into this trial, and it seems like Assistant DA Adam Lally has been presenting a defense for the Alberts and McCabes as opposed to a prosecution against Karen Reed. We still have a long way to go in this trial, but when will we get to the actual crime? Days 5 and 6 in the trial consisted of witnesses from Canton Police Department who were involved in the initial investigation and evidence collection at 34 Fairview, before state police took over. I'll be honest, these 2 days were, for me, by far the most frustrating. There were a lot of issues with the investigation, and I brought up some major issues since the start of this podcast last year, but having the witnesses on the stand and hearing the details of everything, it was even worse than I originally thought. Canton Police Department isn't huge, and they don't handle homicides. And I understand that. However, there are certain things that happened during the course of this investigation that are completely inexcusable, and also give the defense a lot to work with. So let's walk through this investigation. Before we can even get into the details and problems with this investigation, we need to go over a few really important things that were brought up this week about the people involved, especially Sergeant Detective Lank. Before he's brought to the stand in front of the jury to testify, Lank is brought in to be questioned by the defense and the prosecution in front of the judge. The defense wants to bring in information from Lank's past to show his connections to the Alberts so that the jury can be made aware of his potential bias. Lank comes in to do what's called a voir dire, where he is asked questions to find out what he's going to say so that the judge can decide what, if any, of the information is going to come in. We hear that Lank has known the Alberts since childhood and that he was particularly close to Chris Albert, who is on the select board, owns D&E Pizza, and is Colin Albert's dad. Lank and Chris were very close all through school and through their 20s, though Lank says that he doesn't personally socialize with him anymore. As far as his relationship with Brian Albert, Lank says that they're civil and they exchange pleasantries when they see each other. Attorney Alan Jackson begins questioning Lank about an incident that occurred in 2002, highlighting the long history that Lank and the Alberts share. According to court documents, August 31, 2002, several individuals, including Tim Albert, brother of Brian, Chris, and Kevin Albert, had been in a verbal dispute with a man named Mark Lopilato. That same night, Tim Albert, his brother Chris Albert, and Lank were all out drinking at a bar called Centerfields, though today we know this bar as Waterfall. Around 12:45 that night, Mark Lopilato was sitting in the parking lot in a friend's car when he saw a group of several men, including Tim and Chris Albert, leaving Centerfields Bar and approaching the car. Documents say that Mark got out of his car as they approached, and he was then attacked by several men in the group, including Chris Albert. After he was attacked, Mark called his brother, Alfredo Lopilato, and told him that he had just been physically assaulted. Alfredo was at his girlfriend's house asleep, but he came to meet his brother Mark out of concern for his well-being. When Alfredo arrived, he saw Chris Albert. Alfredo knew Chris, so he approached him to ask what had just happened. Documents say that while they were talking, Lank came from the area in front of Centerfields, swaying as he walked. During trial following the incident, Lank would admit to drinking about 4 beers in the 2 hours that he was there. Lank approached the brothers, yelling that he was a police officer, but smelling strongly of alcohol. In that trial, Lank said that he activated himself as a police officer at this time, though he was off duty and drinking. 2 other Canton officers arrived on scene, Lane and Nix. Lank told them to handcuff Alfredo, who wasn't even the brother who had been involved in the altercation. Nix cuffed Alfredo at Lank's request and put him in the back of a cruiser, while Lank approached Mark. Mark told Lank to back off and get out of the way, at which point Lank sucker-punched him in the face with a closed fist and pushed him backwards. Mark was taken down to the ground, Lank on top of him, continuing to hit him. Documents go on to say that Lank then bit Mark in the arm, breaking the skin. The other officers pulled Lank off of Mark, but when Mark asked, "Did you see what just happened?" the officer didn't ask for any identifying information, nothing like that. He just told him to get out of there before he arrests him. Mark sustained a black eye, bruising, and an arm wound with a deep bite mark. Alfredo is still cuffed in the back of the cruiser, and court documents say that Lank approached him, demanding answers, asking, "Who's the other kid?" or "Who's your buddy?" Lank stated, "I'm going to make your life miserable," and then spat directly in Alfredo's face. The same officer who pulled Lank off of Mark then uncuffed Alfredo. After keeping him for about 45 minutes, Alfredo asked, "Did you see him spit in my face?" And the officer responded for him to just get in his car and leave. Despite the swaying and slurred speech and obvious intoxication, Lank got in his car after the incident and drove away. The next morning, Saturday, August 31st, Alfredo went to the Canton Police Department to file a complaint with the Internal Affairs on behalf of his brother and himself, but was sent away. They told him that he would have to come back Tuesday, September 3rd, 3 days away, if he wanted to file a complaint. The day before he was told to come back, on September 2nd, police reports regarding the incident were drafted and filed. When Mark Lopilato went back into Canton PD to make the complaint, he talked to a sergeant and described the officer's conduct and what happened that night, showing him the bruises and the bite mark on his arm. The sergeant told Mark that he would get back to him. The next day, Alfredo called Canton PD and made a verbal complaint, stating that he wanted to come in and talk to someone. The officer that he spoke to said that she would look into it and get back to him. Someone from the department called Alfredo that night and told him that she would be looking into the complaint, but the brothers were never contacted again regarding any outcome or investigation into their complaint. They did, however, receive a summons in the mail a few days after that to appear in court on charges of assault and battery of a police officer. 5 months later, with those charges still pending, the brothers were inside a gas station when Lank walked in, approached them, and asked how they were doing. Mark replied, "Not so good. You attacked me, and now I'm the one who has to go to court." When the brothers walked outside to get in the car to leave, suddenly several cruisers appeared, and Lank ordered Mark to get into his cruiser. Once Mark was inside, Lank asked, Can we talk about this now? When Mark didn't reply, Link placed him under arrest and instructed another officer to take him to the police station, where he was booked and held until 3 a.m. The next morning, he was arraigned on charges of threatening, disorderly conduct, and intimidation. 8 months later, in October of 2003, a jury trial was held in Dedham District Court, and Mark and Alfredo Lopilato were found not guilty of all charges arising from the August 2002 incident. The charges from the gas station were dismissed, and court documents from the civil suit say that the assistant DA who handled the matter even apologized to Mark, stating that after the October trial, he realized that Lank was lying. It didn't end there, though. Documents also say that the Lopilatos have been pulled over repeatedly since then for various motor vehicle citations in Canton. The Lopilato brothers filed a civil suit for their physical injuries, humiliation, embarrassment, and emotional distress, as well as economic loss for Alfredo.
Back in 2002 in August, while you were off duty, were you out either drinking with Chris or in some way at a restaurant or a bar with Chris?
No.
Were you close in proximity to Chris when he was out drinking and at a bar?
No.
Was he at a restaurant?
I don't know where he was.
Were you at a bar?
I was.
At some point, did you realize that Chris was getting into some sort of a physical altercation with somebody else in a parking lot?
Yes.
Did you jump in into a fist fight in order to protect Chris Albert?
Chris actually approached my vehicle and started to describe an altercation that he had been in previously in the night.
Ultimately, when you realized that Chris Albert was in some sort of fracas, some sort of fight or altercation, you activated yourself as a police officer at the time.
He wasn't in a fracas when he approached my vehicle. He approached my vehicle and stated that he had been in an altercation earlier in the night with one of the Lopilato brothers, and that during that altercation, threats were made against him and his family, and he was seeking advice because he knew I was a police officer as to how he should go forward. And as I was telling him what to do, that's when a group of men started to walk down Washington Street towards Chris, and he said, oh no, here they come.
So that would be Mark Lopilato, correct?
Yes.
And his brother, Alfred?
Yes, Alfredo.
Alfredo, sorry. You got out of your car and approached the other men?
Yes.
You also called for a Canton police backup?
I brought my attention to the restaurant owner and a bartender who had walked out into the street, and I yelled for them to call the Canton police.
Canton police did in fact arrive, correct?
They did.
Isn't it true that after Alfredo was handcuffed and for all intents and purposes physically incapacitated, you then approached Mark Lopilato?
No.
You got into a fight with Mark Lopilato, though?
Yes.
You punched him in the face?
At one point after he had struck me, yes.
So your story is he struck you first, and then you punched him?
Yes.
His story, of course, is you punched him first.
I don't know what his story is.
Well, you were sued in federal court, and he told you his story in that lawsuit, correct?
Lank said that he signed a non-disclosure on the settlement with the federal civil suit, so he was unsure of what he was allowed to say here. Jackson asked Lank about his version of events compared to the Lopilato brothers' version of events.
Are you aware of any circumstance in which an individual would be able to punch a police officer on duty or off duty in the presence of other police officers and just be released? That wouldn't happen, would it?
I don't believe the other police officers were on scene when the fight initiated.
Did you tell them that you got punched?
I don't recall.
But they certainly let Mark go, correct?
Mark fled.
Okay.
And then Alfredo was released.
I'm not sure who to believe here. It doesn't seem likely that someone would swing on a police officer, especially when he's outnumbered and his brother is already in cuffs. There are other officers there, but it could happen. Normally, my instinct would be to give trust in what the officer says, but this case goes against every normal instinct I have, especially given what we've seen about some of the officers involved. Also, Lank mentioning that he settled in the federal suit raises some questions for me, as I'm sure it would for a jury. Jackson also brings up the brothers being turned away when they came in to file the complaint. The police report and charges being filed against the brothers after having allowed them to leave looks kind of suspicious. If these brothers were really guilty of assault and battery against a police officer, wouldn't that have been pursued right away? Or at least the next day? But it wasn't. So now, by the time they're able to speak to someone about their complaint against the officers, Lank has already filed a report, causing their complaints to look like a reaction or retaliation against the officer, which kind of diminishes some of the credibility of their complaint. Lank says that there's a reason that he didn't file the paperwork right away.
You didn't file a report for assault or battery or anything like that, correct?
I spoke with my sergeant that night, and he said that I could do the report when I came back in on my next day of work.
My question is, on that night, did you file a report?
No.
The next day, did you file a report?
I don't recall if it was 1 or 2 days later.
It's actually 3 days later, wasn't it?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Lank goes on to say that at the gas station, he didn't approach the brothers. They are the ones who initiated a conversation with him. He admits to saying something to the effect of asking how they were doing, but said that he doesn't recall their response. Lank says that the interaction went further and threats were made, which is why it resulted in an arrest. But Jackson points out that the intimidation charges were thrown out because they were meritless. This entire story is incredibly concerning for multiple reasons. Jackson points out that this is an example of Lank jumping in and using his authority to cover for or take care of an Albert. And he wants the jury to know about that. But I think it also goes far beyond that. If the jury is allowed to hear this, how could they truly trust anything that he says? This is beyond just a drunken bar fight, though that doesn't look good for him either. This incident at the gas station paints Lank as a dirty cop who abuses his power to control others. That's a really big deal, and it speaks a lot to his credibility. Think about it like this. The defense wants the jury to believe that the Alberts, being law enforcement and having such close ties to others in law enforcement, have enough influence to cause other officers to act on their behalf by abusing their power and working the system to get what they want. And here, right in front of them, is an example of someone doing just that. Jackson continues to question Lank, asking him if he did this because he was protecting Chris Albert. But Lank says no. He insists that he would do it for anybody. Really? He got in a fist fight and bit this man on the arm, spat in his brother's face, brought charges against them, and then more charges to continue punishing them, and he would have done that for just anyone? Make it make sense. But there's another issue that's brought up involving Tim Albert, where he apparently slammed into a car that was stopped at a red light in broad daylight and then fled the scene, actually going to 34 Fairview. It wasn't hard to find him. He left a trail of transmission fluid all the way to the house. Lank and Good, who are both involved in this case also, are the ones who handled that, and Lank said that they brought charges against Tim Albert. Jackson points out that the circumstances are different. There was no way to get out of charges for that because he had done significant damage and there was no way to cover it up. Lank said, "I did my job." But when Jackson pushes about him doing his job, this is what he says.
Could you answer the question, please?
I would say I did my job.
Okay. Did you engage in any kind of a DUI investigation?
We spoke with him.
Did you give him FSTs?
I don't recall if I did. I know I didn't. I don't recall if Officer Good did.
Did you give him a breathalyzer?
I did not.
Did you ask him for a blood test?
I did not.
So no DUI investigation was really undertaken, correct?
Again, I can't recall what Officer Good did, but I was there.
But you didn't do it. You didn't do what I just suggested, a full-blown DUI investigation.
No.
Even though he hit another car and then fled the scene.
We spoke with him, and he gave an explanation.
And that explanation coming from Tim Albert was, "I'm really sorry I panicked," right?
It was something to that nature.
I'll just cut to the chase. Y'all ended up charging him with a misdemeanor, correct?
I believe so.
And he was given diversion?
I don't know.
And his record was wiped clean?
I don't know.
That's all I know.
Diversion is some type of alternative sentencing option to avoid a criminal conviction. This could be probation or community service or some type of counseling or classes of some sort. Once he's done that, bam, record is clean. So were charges brought? Yeah, that was unavoidable. But he had no permanent consequences from those charges, and they were wiped clean from his record. Would that have happened if it wasn't an Albert? So Jackson argues that this should be allowed in because the evidence suggests that there could be bias or prejudice, and the jury needs to be able to consider this when determining if they can trust him and his testimony or not. If he's willing to go to these lengths for the Alberts, it could mean that he's willing to do it now, too. Blame Karen, protect the Alberts. Jackson argues that Lank was the very first person to walk into that house. None of the interviews were recorded, so jurors are basically just having to take his word for it and take his word for what he says happened. So Jackson says they need to know what his word is worth. He argues that Lank should have backed off this investigation because he's known the Alberts since childhood, and the jury should know that. Lally argues that this is a trial within a trial. This incident has nothing to do with the Albert brothers. Chris wasn't at the house that night, and this will just confuse the jury. The judge disagrees that it has nothing to do with it, but asks Jackson to get her the police reports from the incidents with the LaPalato brothers so that she can look at them. Jackson agrees that he will get them from Canton PD that evening. The next day, while Good is on the stand for redirect questioning, Lally brings up the hit and run with Tim Albert that Good and Lank worked on together. Lally wants the jury to hear that charges were brought against an Albert so that it can hopefully debunk the argument that these officers protect the Alberts. But keep in mind, the jury doesn't know what we know. We heard the day before of this that, yes, charges were brought against Tim Albert, but he still avoided any kind of criminal conviction, so one could argue that he was still protected. Yannetti asked for a brief recross to address this with Good.
Despite the fact that he was charged, are you aware that the case was just flat out dismissed upon restitution?
Objection, move to strike, Your Honor.
The objection sustained.
Nothing further.
Jurors, you're to disregard that.
So as it stands, the jury is told to disregard what Yannetti said, leaving them with the false impression that charges were brought against an Albert, but not letting them know that the charges were ultimately dismissed. Jackson brings this up to the judge outside the presence of the jury.
I intend to include and elicit in my questioning of Sergeant Lank the issue concerning Tim Albert and the resolution of that issue.
Well, Mr. Yannetti just did that.
Well, he didn't because the court struck it.
Yeah. It should not have been done.
Well, Your Honor,
go ahead.
Respectfully, the Commonwealth left the jurors with a misimpression intentionally.
So
the last question was, and he was charged. That's true. He was charged. And then those charges were dismissed subsequent thereto.
All right, but this was specific. We should have, and it wasn't objected to. Right, so Mr. Lally's question wasn't objected to. All right, so is that the end of what you intend to get into?
Yes.
So, the judge's ruling is that since Jackson didn't object to Lally asking if charges were brought against Tim Albert, the jury is allowed to know that without him having the opportunity to clarify the outcome. The charges were ultimately dismissed upon restitution with no criminal conviction, but the judge says that that doesn't have anything to do with the police or showing police bias, so she won't allow it to come in. As far as Lank, she allows the information about Lank's relationship to the Alberts, but he has to be specific on the relationships individually. She allows the fight and intervening on behalf of Chris Albert to come in, but not the gas station incident because she said that that was more self-serving as opposed to acting on behalf of the Alberts. That part is really big and I think says a lot about his character. I think it's kind of important for the jury to know, but her ruling is her ruling. The jury also isn't allowed to know that the brothers were found not guilty in their trial because that's speculative. She said that there are plenty of reasons that they could have been found not guilty. They also aren't allowed to talk about the federal lawsuit that was brought against Lank. And as far as the police reports, the judge said that she's not allowing that in because she wasn't given the police reports. Even though Jackson followed her specific orders to get copies from Canton PD and get them to the court the night before. He points this out, and eventually we hear that the jury is going to be allowed to know the dates of all of this. So they'll know that the LaPalato brothers were turned away when they tried to file the complaint, and then police reports were drafted. So that's what the jury is able to hear about the potential bias that these officers have when it comes to this family. It's a lot of background and a lot of information, but it's really important when we're looking at who we can rely on in this initial investigation, which we're finally going to get into right after this break. So let's walk through the initial investigation and interviews. Karen had been taken to the hospital for the Section 12 hold. Carrie Roberts left to go pick up John O'Keefe's parents, and the fire and rescue teams were gone. Left on the scene were officers Sarif and Mullaney, Sergeant Good and Sergeant Lank. We know the times of their arrivals based on dash cam videos, but during cross-examination of Officer Sarif, Attorney Alan Jackson points out that the dispatch log, which is the official document generated by Canton Police Department, has the officers' times of arrival wrong. It also has the order of who showed up when wrong, and the address was wrong. Jackson also points out that Sarif gave the wrong address to the grand jury, and said that Sergeant Good also had the wrong address on his report. That prompted Jackson to ask Sarif if there was an effort on his part, or anyone else's, to mask the actual address of Brian Albert's home.
Yes, sir.
Was there an effort on your part or anybody else's, to your knowledge, to mask the actual address of Brian Albert's house as 34 Fairview Road?
No.
All those were just mistakes?
Yes.
Over and over and over?
Yes.
Lieutenant Paul Gallagher from Canton PD was contacted by Sergeant Sean Good shortly after 6 a.m. Good explained the situation, informing Gallagher that there was a Boston police officer who was found unconscious, possibly not breathing, in the snow, and said that his friends had called earlier because he didn't return home that night. Gallagher told Good that he would respond, though he didn't go to Fairview. He actually went to John's house at Meadows Ave first. Karen's car was there in the driveway, as well as John's, but no police or rescue were present, so he called dispatch to get the address. Dispatch officer Kelly Dever told him that the address is 32 Fairview Road, not 34 Fairview, although we know that the address was given multiple times on the 911 call. But he didn't go straight there. When Gallagher left John's house, he actually went to Canton PD first, then to Fairview Road. He said that this is because he needed to go get winter gear, like a jacket and hat, things like that. One thing I can't help but wonder here is if the Ring cameras at John's house picked up video of Gallagher either going by or pulling in. I would assume that when he arrived, he saw that there were no police or fire on scene, so he didn't bother stopping. But I think that if the defense is presenting a case that there was a potential tampering of evidence, they may question an officer going first to John's house, then to Canton PD, then to Fairview Road. When he arrived on scene, Officer O'Keefe had already been taken away. His first conversation was with Sergeant Good, who had called him in, and Lank joined them as well. Gallagher said that they had no idea how John had come to be where he was, so they decided to process the scene where he was found. Sergeant Good and Sergeant Detective Lank directed Gallagher to where John was found. Now, I want to point something out here. Lieutenant Gallagher said that it was Good and Lank who directed him to where John was found. But John had already been moved and placed in the ambulance by the time both of those men had arrived. I feel like that this would be important. If you're going to process a scene where a man was found, wouldn't you want to talk to somebody who actually knows where the man was found and saw him there? Gallagher said that it was snowing heavily at the time, and he estimated about 4 inches of snow on the ground. With the weather, Gallagher said that they knew that this was a unique scene, and Lank had reached out to the Norfolk County CPAC, or Crime Prevention and Control Unit. Protocol for an unattended death is to notify CPAC, who will then have a unit respond and take over jurisdiction. But in this case, CPAC declined to take over at the time because Officer O'Keefe had not yet been pronounced dead, so no state police were on scene or planning to respond yet. Gallagher said that he was concerned with how to process the scene because of some light pink spots in the snow that he believed may be blood.
So we decided on how we were going to process the area. Our concern was there were some light pink spots in the snow, and we thought it may be blood. So we were discussing how to get to that, uncover the blood safely. We decided we were going to process the scene with a leaf blower. I figured we could direct the snow off the area in a controlled fashion. At that time, Sergeant Good volunteered to go get a snow blower. But what I told him in the meantime, I wanted to photograph the area. I wanted all the cruisers away from the house. There was one cruiser, I believe, occupied Officer Saraf directly in front of where Mr. O'Keefe was. I wanted him backed up. And there was crime scene tape set up, and it was blowing wildly in the wind. It was serving no purpose at that time. There were no civilians or witnesses about. And I knew we had two officers who could protect the scene while we processed it.
Sergeant Good said that he told Jen McCabe that he needed to speak to the homeowners, so she needed to go wake them up. She can be seen on video walking up the driveway and the sidewalk to enter her sister's home at 6:34 a.m., where she then apparently burst into the bedroom and woke up Brian and Nicole. Now, this is happening at the same time that Lank is making that phone call to CPAC. But when he sees the light come on at the house, he hangs up and he and Lank go to talk to Brian and Nicole Albert, with Jen McCabe also present. So here's why this is a big deal. The first two officers to speak to the homeowners are two that are potentially conflicted based on their history with the Alberts. You have Lank, who we just spent a lot of time on, and Good, who was the other officer involved in the hit and run with Tim Albert where there was no investigation. They just talked to Tim, and he said that he panicked and left. In a small town where everyone knows everyone, there will always be some overlap, and you're going to respond to calls for people that you know. I could potentially see Good being in that category, even though he's known the Alberts since he was a kid. But Lank? There's no reason why Lank should have gone into the Albert home to talk to them about what was going on. I think it raises too many questions, too many potential problems, and it should have been someone else. Anyone else that doesn't have that history with them. But it wasn't. It was Sergeant Good and Sergeant Lank. Jen was present, but Good said that they didn't speak to her inside because they had already talked to her outside. They did have a conversation with Brian and Nicole in the front room, and Lank took the lead on talking to the couple, while Good said that he kind of moseyed around the front foyer and the dining room that are connected toward the front of the house. Lank described Brian and Nicole as looking like they had just woke up. He said that they spent about 15 to 20 minutes talking to them before going back outside. We can see dashcam video at 6:52 a.m. when the officers were moving their cars to begin processing the scene. Lally points out that there are no footprints in the yard going from the house, though with the snow getting increasingly heavier, I don't really know why that would be a surprise. Good ran home to grab a leaf blower so that they could process the scene, and a video showing how they did this is introduced into evidence. The leaf blower was used to clear an area of somewhere around 6 or 7 square foot, and by clearing the layers of snow, the officers said they were able to expose blood in the snow, as well as a piece of broken cocktail glass. The base of the cocktail glass is what was actually found, and it was entered into evidence. 6 drops of frozen blood found in the snow were also collected and taken back to the station. Seems simple enough, right? Think again. We are about to go through each part of this investigation and the absolute disaster it became. Let's start with the pictures. The only pictures that were taken at the scene were taken later in the morning, but we aren't even sure when. They're low quality, they're hard to see, we don't know when they were taken or how different things looked by the time they were taken, but that's the least of our concerns with this investigation. Let's talk about the collection of the 6 droplets of frozen blood. Here's Lieutenant Gallagher.
Yep, we took 6 blood samples, yes.
Okay, and how were you able to sort of collect the blood samples on scene?
Well, the blood samples, because they were frozen, we debated on how to collect it. We didn't think swabbing was going to be easy to do if it was frozen. So we decided on finding some type of temporary plastic evidence container. We were able to find large cups, and we took 6 samples. We bagged the 6 samples, and Sergeant Lank transported them back to Canton Police Headquarters.
Temporary plastic evidence containers to collect the blood. Sounds very official. Until He has to explain it on cross-examination.
And you indicated your testimony was temporary evidence containers to collect that blood, correct?
Yep, we utilized cups, plastic cups.
Those were red Solo cups, right?
That's correct.
The same kind of red Solo cup you drink beer out of at a barbecue?
Yeah, sure, you could.
Objection, Your Honor. Strike.
I'll allow it.
And where did you get those red Solo cups?
We got them from Lieutenant Kelleher.
So in other words, you got the, to use your words, the evidence containers from a neighbor.
Correct.
He had some Solo cups in his house.
Now, we asked him if he had any plastic containers, any type of plastic container that we could utilize.
How far were you from Kenton PD? From 34 Fairview to Kenton PD? Give me an idea.
Mile and a half.
So even in really bad weather, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, is that right, to drive? You didn't go back to Kenton PD to get actual evidence containers, correct?
We wouldn't have temporary plastic containers, that what we were looking for. We're looking to take samples of snow. We wouldn't have had, I know for a fact we did not have those.
Jackson asked about getting different swabs or other sterile evidence collection receptacles. Anything, really. But Gallagher said that he didn't think any of those are what he needed.
So what you did instead was you gathered red Solo cups from a neighbor, unsterilized, and scooped up the snow with what you thought the blood was and just carried them back to the truck?
Nope. We took six samples, individual samples. Our philosophy was we'll let the crime lab extract it the way they best see fit. Those six samples were bagged and then transported back to Kent Police Headquarters and placed into evidence.
Were they covered?
No, not that I recall.
They weren't sealed in any way?
No.
So if somebody sneezed over the top of one of those cups?
They were sealed in a bag, brown evidence bag. At that time, nobody was going to sneeze over the cup.
Before you took possession of the red Solo cups, do you have any idea how many people before you had handled those Solo cups?
I took them out of a package, so probably none.
How about before they were packaged?
I assume Solo doesn't sell contaminated cups. I would say none.
So they're certainly not forensically stable. They're not sterile.
By your, I don't know what definition you're looking for, but I would agree.
Do you think it's standard practice for a police department to borrow red Solo cups from a neighbor to gather evidence?
Objection.
You can go ahead and answer that, Lieutenant.
Of course not. Nothing about the scene was standard.
Right.
So the cups were collected from Tom Kelleher, who at the time was the lieutenant in charge of detectives and happened to live across the street from Brian Albert. So as shocking as it is to hear that the collection of blood was done with Solo cups, I tried to give a little bit of grace to the department. This is the first homicide that they've been involved in the last 18 years, according to Sergeant Good. This isn't their thing. They usually hand it off to state police. So I wanted to give the benefit of doubt. At least the Solo cups were put in a sealed evidence bag, right? Here's Alan Jackson questioning Detective Sergeant Link.
Did you see a bag sitting next to it?
I do.
That looks like an evidence bag, does it?
No, it looks like a Stop and Shop bag.
Stop
but actually, it looks like an evidence bag. It just doesn't say Canton Police on it. It says Stop and Shop, but it does look like an evidence bag. It's the same thing.
That's a grocery bag.
It is, and that's exactly what our evidence bags look like, so that's what I thought it was at first.
Right, except it doesn't say anything about evidence on it. It says Stop and Shop, correct?
Correct.
What do you think's in that evidence bag? I'm sorry, Stop and Shop bag.
I'm not sure.
You were when these pictures were taken?
I could tell that it's the Canton Police Sallyport, so it's some point after the state police had seized the vehicle.
And at some point after you had brought the Solo cups back to the station?
Correct.
So, we have blood collected in borrowed Solo cups, then placed in a grocery bag, and taken to the Canton Police Department. There are no labels, no sealing tape, no evidence numbers, just six Solo cups in a Stop and Shop bag. So what about the cocktail glass? John O'Keefe was found in the yard of this home with a broken glass, and they didn't know why or how he got there. When Lank called CPAC dispatch, he said, quote, "Not sure if he's been in a fight or whatever," end quote. So they obviously knew that something had happened. I mean, this isn't just a medical issue. This requires some investigation. So if he's found with a broken glass in this yard, my first thought would be to search the house, right? Look around, see if the glass matches any in the house. But that's not what Canton police did. Jackson asked Gallagher, "Did you think that the rest of the broken glass could have been inside the house?" But Gallagher said no. When Jackson asked if he searched the house, he responded, "Absolutely not." This blew my mind. They go back and forth for a bit, and Gallagher insists that he wouldn't have had probable cause. If there's a dead cop in your yard, I would say that's worth pursuing it, or at least asking. But he didn't even try. Why not even ask for a voluntary search? After all, this is the home of another Boston cop. Why not just ask if you can look around? Compare the glassware. Take a look around the house to be able to just rule out anything nefarious happening there. But they didn't even try. No search, no pictures of inside the house or the people inside the house. No attempt to even look to see if they had the same glassware. At this point, the police don't have the video footage from Waterfall yet showing any of their glassware, so to just assume that it must have come from anywhere else other than the house of the yard where he's found blows my mind. The search with the leaf blower was able to at least recover the cocktail glass, though, and the contaminated drops of blood from the snow. But somehow it wasn't enough to find John's missing hat, or shoe, or 45 pieces of bright red taillight. Link said they did the best that they could with the weather and deteriorating situation. Once Karen's car was in the Canton Police Department Sallyport garage, they decided to take the taillight out. This is a few days later, so at this point the state police had taken over jurisdiction because Canton PD was recused out of the investigation. But that didn't stop them from having a Canton police officer come to take the taillight out. It didn't stop Chief Berkowitz, who was out on leave for injury at the time, from getting involved. It didn't stop Berkowitz from driving by Fairview Road almost a week later to look for evidence. Then, as he's driving in this moving car down the road, he happens to see more pieces of taillight, and rather than calling state police, who aren't recused out of this investigation like he calls another Canton police officer, has them come out, and then he calls state police. But the problems don't stop there. The defense brings up the Sallyport at Canton PD, and we find out that pretty much every Canton officer has access to the pedestrian door at the Sallyport. We see pictures from inside the Sallyport where the unsealed bag of Solo cups is on the ground right by the car, bringing up questions of cross-contamination. We hear that the crime scene was left completely unattended, open and available after 8 a.m. because they felt like there was no more scene to preserve. We hear that Gallagher's first interview about his conduct or involvement in this case wasn't done until April of this year, more than 2 years after the investigation. The interview was done with Lally, and Tully was there, but Proctor never interviewed him about his involvement, or recovery of evidence, or the bloodstains, where any of it went, or anything else that he was involved in. Not once. Neither did Bukinic. And to make matters worse, no notes were taken at the scene or the station, and he didn't even write a report on anything until January of this year, when the metadata was requested on the photos. How's that even possible? Gallagher did go to the scene with Proctor and the crash reconstructionist, but yet he never saw where John was or how he was laying when he was found, and the officers who relayed that information to him didn't actually see John either. We hear that the police report has everyone's names listed out except for Brian Albert. For some reason, his is just listed as B. Albert, and Higgins' address is listed as the police station address. The photos on the face sheet of Good's report are changed, but the date is still listed as the date that the report was originally written. Now, this wouldn't be a big deal if there were documentation somewhere else in his report that there was a supplement done with a date to show when the changes were made. But, of course, there isn't one. Good looked at the report and said that his narrative didn't change, and he doesn't know who added the pictures to the report so that they're on the face sheet. At every corner you turn, there's another problem. There were two other things that were brought up by the officers. First, Good said that while he was working dispatch on the night of John's death, he saw Higgins come into the station around 1:30 a.m. He didn't know why he came in, and he can't remember if he saw him on the monitors or in person, but he did see him come in. Also, dash cam footage is played by Lieutenant Charles Ray from Canton PD, who went by John's house to do a wellness check when he thought the kids may be at the house. Dash cam in the driveway shows Karen's car, and on the right rear side, you can see the cracked taillight from the back, though there are no photos taken or side views. Is any of that going to be enough to convince a jury one way or the other? It's too soon to tell, and there's still a lot more evidence to be introduced. We'll be right back. Days 7 through 11 have been all about the witness testimony from that night, starting with who was present at C.F. McCarthy's, and then Waterfall, and then the Alberts residence. Michael Camerano was the first of John's friends to be called to the stand. Mike met John through Kurt and Carrie Roberts about 7 years ago. His kids are close friends with John's niece and nephew, and Mike and his wife Catherine, or Katie, would spend time with John and Karen often. Friday, January 28th, John's niece and Michael's daughter, who are close friends, both got their acceptance letters into a high school that they had applied to, and it was a big deal, a very proud dad moment for each of them. Michael and his daughter went to John's that evening to hang out for a while and celebrate. After a while, the guys decided to let the girls hang out at the house while they went out for a little bit to C.F. McCarthy's. Mike said that Karen was going to be meeting them there as well, and before they left John's house, they actually rearranged the cars in the driveway to make room for Karen to park in the garage when she got there since the snowstorm was coming. I thought that was really sweet and gentlemanly. Video footage shows the guys entering C.F. McCarthy's and having a seat at the bar. They decided to text Kurt Roberts, the husband of Carrie Roberts, and told him to come down there and hang out with them. Kurt said that he was busy, but they taunted and teased him, telling him he needed to come. Kurt testified that he ended up coming only because he couldn't let the guys call him names for not coming. Hearing these two friends describe their relationship with John was truly endearing. Kurt has been married to Carrie Roberts for 15 years. He and Mike Camerano grew up together, but Kurt met John when John moved into his sister's house after her death to take care of the kids. They've been friends ever since. Kurt, Mike, and John ran into another buddy at the bar named Sully, who they know because their kids all play ball together. So they talked to him for a while, too. Karen shows up, and we can see her walking into C.F. McCarthy's on the video. She heads over to John, who's sitting at the bar with the guys. He reaches out, and he hugs her. They kiss. They appear to be really affectionate toward each other. Everyone's laughing, smiling, having a good time. The guys were drinking beer out of a bottle, and Karen had a glass with a clear liquid in it and a lime. Kurt left at some point and went home to go to bed. Mike got a call a little while later that his son had been hit with a hockey stick, so he had to take off too. Mike left and went to pick up his daughter from John's house around 11 and then went home. He put his phone on the charger and went to bed. Mike said the next morning he woke up to his phone ringing. He had several calls from Karen Reed and from his wife's work. Mike's wife, Catherine, said that Karen had called her while she was at work, screaming, "Where's Mike?" She could hear Kylie, John's niece, in the background. Text and call records between Catherine and Karen were entered into evidence. The first call from Karen to Catherine was at 4:49 that morning. There are a number of calls that follow. Kurt said that he was asleep that morning when he woke up to screaming on his wife Carrie Roberts' phone. Carrie got up, got dressed, and left to go meet Karen and Jen McCabe. Karen texted Catherine at 5:53 to tell her that she's driving around with Carrie and Jen to look for John. Catherine questions her to make sure that one of them is driving and not Karen because she said that Karen was hysterical. She then calls her husband Mike and tells him to go pick up Kaylee because she's home alone. So Mike Camerano gets to John's and said that the right side of the garage had the door open. This is the side that they park in, since John's convertible stays on the other side of the garage. Mike said that the garage door wouldn't go down, and he thought that maybe it's because of the snow blocking the sensor, so he grabbed a shovel and tried to clear some of the snow out of the way, but he still couldn't get it to shut. He said that John was very particular about his house, his garage, his yard, and everything else. The kind of house where you take your shoes off and line them up neatly before coming inside. Since the garage door wouldn't close, Mike said that he manually pulled it down with a rope, and he used the side locks to lock it, and then he exited through the side garage door. He said that he needed to shut the garage door because he knew that John would go crazy if he came home and there was snow in his garage. Catherine said at 6:34 that morning, she texted Karen and asked, "Any luck?" And Karen replied, "He's dead." All three witnesses are asked some of the same questions. First, about Karen and John's relationship. Here's what Mike had to say.
What, if any, conversation do you recall having with Mr. O'Keefe in regard to his relationship with Mr.
Just regular guy conversations.
Anything specific that you can recall?
No.
And his responses to Alan Jackson.
You saw them on most Friday nights, right?
Correct.
You never saw them argue or fight?
Argue.
Matter of fact, one time you were asked about this in front of a grand jury, and you said, "I wouldn't even call it bickering. They would just banter together."
I guess so, yes.
You never heard Mr. O'Keefe even hint at the idea of breaking up with Ms. Reed?
Not that I can recall.
While you were at C.F. McCarthy's with them, you didn't observe any arguing or bickering between the two of them?
No.
As a matter of fact, they were sort of the normal, affectionate, laughing, happy couple that you were used to seeing, correct?
Yes.
There didn't seem to be any tension between them and C.F. McCarthy's, is that right?
Not that I recall.
All right. I want to just draw your attention to the month before Mr. O'Keefe's passing. Would you describe their relationship to be normal, as far as you knew it to be?
Yes.
And on the day before Mr. O'Keefe's passing, would you describe their interactions to be normal and caring and affectionate?
Yes.
And here's Kurt Roberts' answer.
During the time that you spent with them at the bar, you didn't see any evidence of any problems between Karen and John O'Keefe?
I did not.
No arguments or bickering or anything like that?
No.
Neither one of them was complaining about the other, correct?
Correct.
They were also all asked about Karen and her relationship to the kids. Here's what Mike had to say.
You never heard Mr. O'Keefe complain about Ms. Reed or vice versa?
No, I did hear him complain about, like, when Karen would buy, like, very nice things for the kids, like, he wouldn't like that, stuff like that, or take the kids to get their nails done or something like that.
So maybe spoiling the children?
Yes, yes.
Certainly nothing to suggest that there was any abuse or anything like that. It was just a matter of fact.
Correct, correct.
Mr. O'Keefe had an idea about how to raise children that was maybe a little bit more modest than Ms. Reed did.
Correct.
So you described earlier at another hearing, you described a situation in which Ms. Reed got a very extensive sweater for Mr. O'Keefe's niece.
Correct.
And Mr. O'Keefe's response was, "Boy, I wish he hadn't done that. That's spoiling that little girl."
Yes.
All right. You would agree there are worse things in the world than spoiling a child.
Correct.
Yes.
I'll let it stand.
And here's Kurt Roberts.
From your observations of Karen Reed during that 1 or 2 years that you had come into contact with her, the contact you had mainly surrounding what happened with the kids, correct?
Yeah, I would say. I mean,
it appeared to you as though Karen was caring for the kids and caring about them, correct?
Correct.
The focus then shifts to witnesses from the waterfall, where John and Karen went that night when they left C.F. McCarthy's. Rebecca Trayers, a bartender at Waterfall, is brought in to testify. She gives testimony about the glassware that they use at the bar, about state police speaking to her. They apparently spoke to her somewhere other than Waterfall, and about collecting the video surveillance and receipts from that night. Rebecca has worked at Waterfall for 7 years, but has bartended in Canton for 11 years, so she knows some of the Alberts. She explains that they were sitting at a high-top table that's closest to the bar, and a band was playing that night. She said that she didn't overserve anyone, nobody seemed really drunk, and John left her a nice tip. But John's bill was only $16. He had one Bud Light, one Miller Lite, and one Tito's drink on there. We also hear testimony from Nicholas and Karina Kolokathis. Their kids had a basketball game that night, and some of the other parents, including the McCabes, decided to go after the game to Waterfall, so they decided to join. While they were there, they said that there was no arguing or fighting. Everyone was having a good time and in good spirits. Brian Albert invited them to come back to his home as well, but they ended up going home. Karina said toward the end of the night, she parked on Washington Street near where Karen parked, and when she saw Karen leaving with John, she was surprised because she thought that Karen was going somewhere with Jen McCabe.
Karen went over to John, something like that. He put his arm around her. I don't know if they had a conversation. They talked. It seemed like they were, like, quite lovey-dovey at that point. And then that's when Jennifer McCabe went up to Karen and said, "You're coming with me." Like, and she, like, grabbed her. Like, she put her arm around her, and she said in front of me, she's like, "You're coming with me. You're coming with me."
And just to be clear, like, sort of how she said that, was that in sort of a forceful way, or
no, like joking around, like, "Hey, you know, you come with me. We're gonna, you know." And Karen said, "Where are we going?" And Jen said, "It doesn't matter. It'll be a surprise." Like, it was like something like that.
And at some point, when you're outside of the Waterfall, do you see Mr. O'Keefe at that point?
I did. All of a sudden, it was weird. I see Karen with John, and I was like, "Oh, that's weird. I thought she was going with Jen." And that's just what made me notice it. It was that the whole, like, Jen wanting Karen to go with her, and then all of a sudden, I see Karen with John. I just thought, I was just like, "Oh." So it made me notice it.
Nicholas and Karina were both asked the same questions that the other witnesses were asked about John and Karen's relationship and about the kids. Here's Nicholas.
When you socialized with Ms. Reed and Mr. O'Keefe, did you ever see any sort of tension between the two of them?
Not at all.
Did they seem like a normal and loving couple?
Absolutely.
They seemed like they were affectionate and normally affectionate with one another?
Absolutely.
Did you ever have any question about the nature of their relationship, any toxicity in the relationship, or any overt indicators that they weren't getting along?
Not to my knowledge, not at all.
You knew that Mr. O'Keefe and Ms. Reed had rekindled a previous relationship from years earlier?
Yes, I did.
And you knew that Mr. O'Keefe was excited about that?
Yes.
Was there a time in which Ms. Reed was actually singing John's praises that night?
Yes, I did.
What a great daddy was.
Yep.
Objection. Move to strike.
I'm going to strike that. Next question.
Nothing eventful at the bar, while you were at the bar with Mr. O'Keefe and Ms. Reed, that comes to mind in terms of any kind of tension or fight that night?
Tension or fight? Absolutely not.
No argument that was audible to you?
Absolutely not.
You didn't see any body language between the two of them that would suggest an argument or a fight or tension?
In fact, I noticed the opposite.
Describe that.
They were affectionate toward each other, loving toward each other, and to the point where my wife even made a comment, why are you not like that with me?
You had something to live up to.
Yes.
And here's his wife, Karina.
With respect to the defendant's relationship with Mr. O'Keefe, what, if anything, did she say about that?
So she started by saying how much she admired him, how much he did for the children, just how she looked up to him for that. She started with that. Well, she started talking about my kids first, and then she started talking about John.
So she spoke about your kids?
About my daughter, yeah.
A little bit of a glowing fashion, is that correct?
She did. She always had a way of, like, saying, she seemed to love my younger daughter, and she said that she really liked my daughter's relationship with John's niece. So she first started with that conversation, and then she went on talking about John and his relationship.
And then after she talked a little bit about that, what, if anything else, did she talk about?
So she started talking about how much he sacrifices, how he's, like, unconditionally puts all his time and effort into the kids, how she admired him for that, and how she also wished that some of the family members would step up and help out a little bit more, because he took all the burden on himself.
And what, if anything else, did she say about that in relation to sort of their relationship?
Just that she wished they had a little bit more time to, you know, go out, go on dates, go on vacation. But she did mention that they had planned a trip or something like that, that she was excited about.
So far, everything we've heard about Karen, her relationship with John, and how she was with the kids was pretty positive. Now we move on to the Alberts. Next up, Chris and Julie Albert. Chris Albert met John O'Keefe when they were both living on Meadows Avenue, just a few doors down. Over the years, John became friendly with some other people that Chris is friends with, so they would run into each other. But he said John also came in to D&E Pizza frequently and would bring his nephew Patrick to grab a slice, sometimes a couple times a week. D&E is the pizza shop that Chris Albert has owned for the last 25 years. Chris's wife Julie knows John through Jen McCabe, but she doesn't know Karen very well. She said that she's never really spent time with her socially without John there. Julie had gone to 34 Fairview that Friday, January 28th, sometime around 7:30, to pick up her sister-in-law Nicole Albert and her niece Caitlin. Chris says that on that Friday, John and Patrick came into D&E, and John asked him about going out later. Chris told him that it's his nephew's birthday, so he knows that a bunch of people are going out. He told him he'd text him later, maybe they could join, so they swapped phone numbers. The pizza shop closes at 10, and Chris's wife, Julie Albert, brought Chris some clothes to change into so that he could meet everyone out. Chris said he left D&E about 10 minutes before closing time and walked over to Waterfall to meet his wife and family. He texted John, who was still at CF McCarthy's, and ordered a beer and some food, and hung out with everyone. Brian Higgins and Brian Albert arrived about half an hour later. John texted Chris back, asking who was there, and Chris told him. When Chris said that Brian was there, John asked if he meant his brother Brian, and he also asked where his other brother Kevin was. Eventually, John and Karen show up. Chris said that he had met Karen outside of John's house before, and she's come into the pizza place a few times, but he didn't really know her either. He said Karen came in with a glass in her jacket. He described it as a clear liquid in a cylindrical glass with a lime. That description stood out to me because it's the exact description in the probable cause affidavit, so that's interesting. It shows that he was either prepared or scripted, or both. Chris said that he thinks Karen came in and sat next to Julie. John went to the bar to get a drink, and everyone was having a good time that night. No arguments, no fighting, no bad vibes. Julie got a migraine and decided to leave early, and Chris is seen on video leaving around 12:14. He walks home, probably just a 5 to 7 minute walk, goes upstairs, and goes straight to bed. He said that Colin opened the door to tell him and Julie goodnight, that he loved them, and he was home. He estimated that to be about 10 minutes after he got in bed. Julie said that she woke up about 8-ish that next morning, and she noticed that she had a missed call from Jen McCabe. The missed call was at 5:55 that morning, but there was no voicemail or text. She went to Dunkin' Donuts to get donuts for Brian Jr.'s birthday because she said that every year she takes him 6 donuts and a card so that he has them when he wakes up. She said that she pulled in the driveway and she saw Jen's car. At this time, she said that it's about 8:30. She walked over to leave the donuts in Brian Jr.'s car, and Brian Albert opened the door and told her to come inside. Brian, Nicole, Jen, and Matt McCabe, and Brian Higgins were all inside in the kitchen. That's when they told her that something had happened to John. She said that she was there about 30 to 45 minutes and then went home to wake up her husband, Chris, and tell him. Chris said that he woke up at 8 or 8:30, but he stayed in bed. And when Julie came in a little while after that to wake him up, she told him that John had been found in the yard at 34 Fairview and had died. He said that he was in shock, so he jumped up, got dressed to go to his brother's house, and they arrived about 9 or 9:30. He said when he got there, Brian and Nicole, Jen and Matt McCabe, and Brian Higgins were all there at the kitchen table. They stayed for about an hour and then went home. Within a few days, state troopers came to his home to talk to him. The timelines for Chris and Julie aren't exact, but that's to be expected. Julie said she was up at 8, leaves for Dunkin' Donuts. Chris said he was up between 8 to 8:30. Julie estimated that she left Fairview the first time around 9 or 9:15. Chris estimated that they got to Fairview, which would be the second time that Julie went, around 9 or 9:30. Chris said that they stayed for about an hour. Julie said they stayed for about half an hour. So everything's a little bit off, but these are estimates, and this was 2 years ago, so I don't see anything really suspicious about that. During the cross-examination of Chris Albert, David Unetti brings up a text that he sent John at 9:45 that night saying to get over here before I F up your lawn. We hear that Chris Albert and his family referred to John O'Keefe as Nevercracker, referring to the character in the cartoon called Monster House. He was an old curmudgeon that would yell at everyone to get off his lawn. Unetti said that this was based on a conflict that started when Chris's son, Colin, would cut through John's yard. We've heard how particular he was about his house and his yard. Unetti said that Colin would flip him off and say F you to him, even throwing beer cans and beer bottles in his bushes. Chris said that that's not accurate. He said that his younger son was running through John's yard one day before John put up the fence, and he said that John yelled at him, "Hey kid, get off my lawn." Chris said that his son came home upset because it scared him, so Chris's wife Julie called Jen McCabe, who then called John. He said that John felt bad. He was just joking. He didn't realize that he scared the kid, so he asked what his favorite type of candy was, and he brought him a bag of candy and said, "I'm sorry, I was just joking." He said that that's why they gave him the name. Unetti shows a picture of Chris and Julie Albert straddling John's new fence out front and smiling for the camera, taking a picture to send to John. Unetti asks if they did that because they knew that it would annoy him, knowing that he doesn't like people on his lawn. And he points out the text that Chris sent John that night was also taunting him about the lawn. Chris said that John was out of town when that picture was taken, so they were watching his yard for him and sent it as a joke. David Unetti also brings up some of the power that he says that the Albert family has. Unetti asks Chris about his position as a town selectman, saying that that gives him some power in this town since one of the functions of the select board is overseeing public safety, including the Canton Police Department. It's worth noting, though, that Chris Albert wasn't a selectman at the time of John's death. He was elected a couple months later. He also knows Kenneth Berkowitz, who was the police chief at the time. He's known him for about 20-plus years, and he says that they're friends. When he's shown a picture of them together, he even refers to him as Kenny on the stand. And he's been close to Lieutenant Michael Blank since he was like 12 years old. During Julie's cross-examination, the Proctor problem came into play. The Proctor connection is a big issue, and I've said that from the beginning. It's a problem, and as we are working our way through the trial, it will continue to be a problem. And we haven't even got to his testimony or investigation yet. But while on the stand, Chris Albert says that he's known Proctor for about 15 years or so. And Julie Albert, Chris's wife, said on the stand that Courtney Proctor, who is Michael Proctor's sister, is one of her best friends. They socialize together, go out for drinks. She provides childcare for her children. That was actually a question that was objected to by Lally, and the judge sustained it, but not before Julie answered yes. As soon as she did, she realized that she had messed up. She closed her eyes and made a face. Unetti even points out that Courtney recommended Julie watch Proctor and his wife's children as well. We hear about Julie being very close to the family. Her son Colin was even a ring bearer in Courtney Proctor's wedding. She spent time at Michael Proctor's childhood home, has been to the pool at his house about a dozen times. The list goes on. But when Julie was on the stand, this very interesting interaction came out.
You talk regularly, correct?
Yes.
You text each other, correct?
Yes.
You also talk by phone?
Very rarely.
Did you say very rarely you talk
phone, usually, you talked about usually phone? It's text.
But do you stand by that testimony that you talked to Courtney Proctor very rarely by phone?
Do we have a time frame? Do you mean now or do you mean then?
Let me ask you this. Between February 1st of 2022 and September 6th of 2022, did you only speak rarely with Courtney Proctor?
I don't recall.
Were you using Courtney Proctor as an intermediary to communicate with Michael Proctor about this case?
Objection.
I'll allow it.
No, I was not.
Are you aware that between February 1st of 2022 and September 6th of 2022, you and Courtney Proctor spoke by phone 67 times?
Objection.
Were you aware of that?
No, I don't know the exact count.
Do you deny that you spoke 67 times?
I don't deny it, but I don't recall the exact amount of times.
Okay, so you don't deny that you spoke 67 times. You still want to maintain your testimony that you only talked very rarely with Courtney Proctor during that time period.
I just don't remember the exact amount of times.
Look, everyone has a different definition of what rarely means, but that's more than twice a week. I don't think talking on the phone to someone more than twice a week falls under the rarely category for anyone that I know. But it doesn't stop there. The timing of the phone calls is also brought up. There was a 12-minute phone call on February 1st, which is the same day that Karen was arrested. And it's more than a week before Proctor came to talk to Julie and Chris. Yannetti asked Julie if she remembers this and if they discussed the case, or if Proctor had discussed the case with his sister and that's why they were talking. She can't recall. The following day, February 2nd, Julie and Courtney Proctor talked on the phone 3 times before 9 a.m. So why is this significant? Because Karen Reed was arraigned at 9 a.m. and it was publicly televised. After the arraignment, she talked to Courtney Proctor again for 27 minutes. Again, Julie doesn't recall. Yannetti points out this is problematic. The arrest and arraignment was a big deal, and it involves Julie's family. Of course, it's natural to talk to your friends about it. But if you're talking about a case that involves your family to your best friend, who is the family of the lead detective, that is a conflict. Period. There's no reason that Proctor should have been on this case, especially since he hasn't even come to interview her yet. Yannetti asked Julie if any of those 67 phone calls with Courtney Proctor were discussing the case. Julie doesn't deny it, but she doesn't remember. He asks if she told Courtney during any of these phone calls that she was a witness in her brother's case. But she doesn't remember. He brings up Julie telling Courtney that she was nervous about talking to her brother, Michael Proctor, about the case. She was worried that one of Trooper Proctor's colleagues would want to talk to her son, Colin. Julie says that the interview with Proctor wasn't really long. It was done at her house in the family room, sitting around on the couches around 5:30 that evening. Yannetti asked Julie about calling Proctor's personal cell phone at 6:17 that same evening after he had left. This presents a problem. Julie doesn't remember why she called or what it was about, but Yannetti, when he asks how she got his personal cell phone number, she agreed that it was probably given to her years ago since she's known the family for so long. He mentions Julie remembering the missed call from Jen McCabe at 5:55 a.m. on January 29th, but says that she can't recall any of the 67 phone calls between herself and Courtney Proctor. This case has been pretty wild so far, and after Chris and Julie's testimony, things got even wilder. There's too much to cover in just one episode, so you'll be getting a bonus episode this week before next week's episode. There's a lot to discuss. Court was completely put on hold while Lally fought to have Aiden Carney, aka Turtle Boy, removed from court. There's also been drama and police called to the press line outside of the courthouse, forcing a change of rules on media from the court. Brian and Nicole Albert, the homeowners at 34 Fairview, took the stand, and the cross-examination was pretty explosive for Brian Albert. Their son, Brian Jr., their daughter, Caitlin, and her boyfriend, and Brian Jr.'s friends that were there that night have all taken the stand. You won't want to miss this. On the next episode, the bonus episode of 13th Juror Podcast, Conspiracy in Canton. My name is Brandy Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.